All right, we got here founder of High Country Finance, Brady Slack. Thank you so much for taking your time to come onto the podcast.
No, thanks for the invite. I'm excited for the conversation.
Absolutely, man. This is going to be really exciting. When I saw this one hit the calendar, I've been following you on Instagram. I've seen you on social medias, and you're one of the few, sadly, the industry itself, but very cool that you're this way. Few CPAs and owners of CPA firms that actually care about their clients when it comes to proactive type of planning and making sure a small business owner's needs are met over time. And so as someone who is in a similar industry, I really appreciate all the work that you do. So I'm very excited to get tactical today.
Well, thank you. I think, fortunately, I'm probably not one of the few. I think there's a lot more that are out there that take the planning approach to advisory services when it comes to tax. But unfortunately, there's only a select few who actually, you know, kind of put their face in front of a camera and hop on social media, and shout out to the few of us that do that, I guess.
Fair enough. Fair enough. I appreciate you giving us that perspective. Now let's go into that a little bit deeper. Talk to me about, like, one, your journey kind of in this space, because you know you potentially have to go from school into just like accounting, and then the owner and the entrepreneurial side of the CPA stuff. Talk to us a little bit about your journey, and then I want to get a little bit more tactical about the business model itself, so our listeners can understand kind of what internally it looks like from a CPA firm side.
Yeah. I kind of got tripped and pushed into tax. That wasn't maybe my initial plan, if you will. I was studying accounting and personal financial planning in school. But my girlfriend's dad at the time, he has a really successful business, said, "Hey, my accountant needs some help. Do you want to go work for him?" And he just so happened to be paying more than where I was currently working. And I was like, great, I'll get experience and I'll make a little bit more money, right? Lucky for me, I ended up marrying that girl. So that's now my father-in-law, and everything worked out there, right? But no, I started working at that firm kind of like an intern tax preparer in that sort of a role. But I worked my way into more of an advisory role with a lot of our clients fairly quick. And I was there with them for about 3 years, 2.5, 3 years before some events happened that allowed me to transition out of that firm and into my own firm, which is High Country Finance. Again, just a lot of luck. And I think as entrepreneurs, you need to take advantage of those, you know, minuscule lucky opportunities. And I had two or three of those roll my way, and I took full advantage of them. So that's kind of how I got started into the industry. And why I started High Country Finance was a couple lucky breaks to go do some trainings and build a client base that way, a book of business that morphed into what it is today, which now High Country Finance is a full service tax and accounting advisory firm. And the reason why I say advisory is, yes, we still do like the bookkeeping. Yes, we still prepare and file tax returns, but our emphasis is on what's going to happen in the future, not what has happened in the past, which is a very traditional way of doing tax and accounting.
Well said. Well said. Well, I appreciate you getting us up to speed there. One of the things I want to shift towards is understanding the business model of maybe a traditional CPA firm versus why you took the approach that you're taking. Because what I've come to find, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, because you're more on the front lines of this than I am. A lot of clients come to me and they're just like, "Hey, my CPA is just not proactive. They're not giving me any type of strategy. And all they're looking to do is just file my taxes." And I hear this a lot. And I understand it from a sense of, like, some of their business models are designed just to churn as many tax returns out as possible.
Yeah.
How do you make sure that as a business owner, you've built in the margins to be able to sustain that wide array of services, given the fact that advisory is sometimes ambiguous and sometimes not as profitable as just maybe having a tax return machine, et cetera. Can you explain to me a little bit more about how you went about changing your business model from the norm?
Yeah, when I started High Country Finance, I took the model of the firm that I was working at because I figured it was working, right? And it was just kind of a tax return factory. Let's pump as many tax returns out as we can and bring as many clients in as we can. I realized through about two tax seasons that I was just absolutely working like a dog, and it wasn't fun for me. And I think traditionally accounting and tax works that way. They just try and get as many people through the door. It's really common in accounting, especially if you go work for like a big four firm, you know, KPMG, PwC, Deloitte, that you're working 60, 80 hour weeks, you know, and that's the norm. But the general population, the business owners always view accounting as a cost, not an investment. And so what that equates to is we're overworked and we're underpaid. That's kind of what the industry has come to. The switch for me, I think, took place when I realized that the tax return is a byproduct of the planning that goes into it. Mm. And if there is no planning that ever goes into that tax return, you're going to get the same, kind of the definition of insanity is doing the same thing repeatedly, expecting a different result. That's kind of what people have done historically with their tax returns, is they've just met with their accountant one time during the year to file the return, and they expect that something is going to change on their tax return. So the accounting industry, I think, is going through a big shift to more of an advisory model. You know, we went through the great resignation in 2020 with COVID, and, you know, people realizing, hey, I can maybe go do my own thing. And they crave this idea that maybe I could pay no tax like the wealthy. How do I do that? What do I need to implement into my structure to be able to take advantage of the breadth and depth that the tax code actually is? And so the advisory model, I think, is actually more prevalent today than it ever has been. But what a lot of people don't understand, and this happens quite frequently when they hop on consultation calls with us, is we'll go through the different services and ways that we could help the client, and then we tell them our price. And we are not the cheapest option. You know, if you want a cheap option, continue to file with TurboTax or H&R Block, because that is what the cheap option is. But if you want real tax savings, you do have to look at it as an investment. And the clients that we have who do make the most money consistently, pay the fewest taxes consistently, they view us as more like a partner and an investment into the total net outcome of their investments.
I really like the language that you use. The tax return is just a byproduct of the planning that's involved. Because the reason why I like that a lot too is because it puts a lot of accountability on multiple parties. Because a lot of business owners, sometimes they come out and say, oh, it's just my CPA's fault. But it's like, well, did you give them books in a proper amount of time? How many times did you reach out to them? Did you let them know that you were buying property, et cetera, et cetera? So yeah. I think it's a collaborative effort in a consistent manner. Let's shift gears a little bit towards some specifics. So, I mean, we have so many different case studies and scenarios that I love to walk through. Yeah. But I'd love to keep this context of this podcast specific to small business owners, let's say service-oriented models, seven figures and above in revenue, to where we have some margin that we can play around with and do some planning. Where does your head go, and how do you go about when you're engaging your business owners? Walk us through your process and what you're trying to understand first so that you can start laying out recommendations based on what their vision is.
Yeah. The first thing that I think people need to understand is ultimately it's your situation, right? Like I can't go make money for you. I can't go spend money for you. I can't go invest money for you. So kind of like what you just said, Antonio, like it is, there's got to be some give and pull. Like we just had a client, and the reason I'm kind of setting this story up, but we just had a client last week who ultimately we fired. The situation was not very good, and there were some things that we could have done better, and I will fully admit that, you know, but ultimately the client wanted his tax returns done for 2023, and we still haven't received information that we've needed to complete an accurate representation of the financials for 2023. So I am not going to file an illegitimate tax return if I haven't received the information that I need from the client. And I can't go procure that information. Like the client has to provide that information. So I say that because when I step into a consultation or when I step into a tax planning meeting, there's a couple things that I'm trying to understand first from an advisor's perspective. One, what does your situation look like? How are you making your money? What are some of the potential margins that we would envision that your business should have from a general standpoint? What entities do you have, and what income or revenue streams do you have through those entities? Is the income passive or is it active? Because those have different tax treatments and they have different tax opportunities, right? And then once I kind of understand what the situation is, I really like to understand, and I think this is probably the most important piece, but I really want to understand what does the client want? What are the client's goals? How do they want to make money? How much of that money do they want to make? Because then I can formulate an idea or a plan or a strategy, if you want to call that, so that they can achieve some of those goals through good tax planning.
I love that. Okay, awesome. So now we engage the client. Client is, let's say, a little bit less on the mature side when it comes to how long they've been in business, earlier in their life cycle, but starting to bring some significant revenue amount in. Everyone talks about an S-corp. Walk us through the advantages and disadvantages of S-corps, because I've come across people that have just been single member LLCs, and then across people that have 30 S-corps and everything's an S-corp.
Yeah.
So help me understand where your head goes when you decide to make an S-corp election, but also tell us a little bit more about what is an S-corp election.
Yeah, okay, really good questions. First and foremost, an S-corporation is a tax-elected status of an entity. So when you register your business with the state and create a legal entity, you are creating either an LLC or a corporation at its most basic form, right? And LLCs and corporations have different tax treatments. Corporations have their own tax rates. They're taxed as separate entities. LLCs are called flow-through entities. But the most important thing out of this entire conversation that I want people to understand is LLCs do not provide you with any tax opportunity. They're strictly limited liability companies. They're for the protection of assets. Okay, that's one of the biggest reasons why people set up LLCs. They do not have tax favorability, if you will. But what happens is if I'm owning a business and I have an LLC, I'm responsible to pay, as the owner of that LLC, taxes on my net profits at whatever income tax rates I'm going to be taxed at based on my gross income. The problem with that is if it's active income, that income is subject to self-employment taxes, which is an additional 15.3%. Okay. You start to creep up into higher amounts of net profits, 50,000, 100,000, 150,000, 300,000, that 15.3% can start to add up. You know, you might as well bend over to Uncle Sam because you're going to be forking over a lot of money. However, the S corporation was created as a way to kind of get the benefit of both worlds between a corporation and an LLC. You get some tax favorability of a corporation. However, you get the pass-through benefits of an LLC. So you're still taxed at your ordinary income rates. So when I have an LLC, and this is going to range depending on the accountant you're talking to, but I say when you have a net profit in your business at or above $40,000, give or take, you should elect to be taxed as an S corporation, especially if that net profit is projected to continue to stay at the same rate or increase. Okay. Now, the reason you're going to hear accountants say $35,000 to $50,000, typically, not all the time, but typically, is because what we try and evaluate is when you are now an S corporation, there are some new requirements from a tax perspective. I've got to pay myself a reasonable compensation, which is a W-2. I need to have proper financials and balance sheets, which typically LLCs are not required to have for tax purposes. And then there are some additional record keeping items that you've got to have. You've got to file an additional tax return. But what I'm looking at, Antonio, is I want to make sure that the cost of all those additional services that I've now got to pay for are going to be less than the total tax with my LLC. That's and depending on the fees that your service provider has, that $35,000 to $50,000 range in net profits is typically a break-even point for you. But
sure.
That S corporation now allows you to take your ordinary income and not have to pay self-employment taxes on the totality of the net profit, just the amount you pay yourself in that reasonable compensation. That's kind of a nut breakdown, but we can go into more questions if you have any.
Sure. Yeah. So for example, let's take the micro example of $50,000 of net profit. How do I know what to pay myself, and how do you as an accountant teeter-totter based off the qualified business income deduction as well, and how do we maximize all that?
Really good question on section 199. How much you pay yourself, I think, is dependent on a couple different factors. One, what is the actual role or responsibility that you have in your business? What are potential comparable pay rates that your industry or that specific job is paying? For example, I've got one individual who works as a physician, but every medical office that she works at, she's paid as a 1099, and so she has an S corporation, and her gross income is a little bit over $1 million a year. But because she's acting as a physician, we can't list her wage as $100,000 because comparably in her area, physicians don't get paid $100,000 a year. They're getting paid $250,000, $300,000, $400,000 a year. So her wage needs to be a little bit higher. I've got another individual who they also get paid through an S corporation. However, the majority of their operations are ran by the team, and they are just there basically as an office person at this point. So we have the flexibility to decrease their wage a little bit because they're not actually as active in the business as other people would be, right?
Now, here's a nuanced question on that specific example. Because of the fact that they're, let's say, like they've pretty much removed themselves from the business, but they have a significant amount of income, let's say a million net profit and over. There obviously are scenarios where it could be beneficial to create that as technically passive income, but then we also encounter, and correct me if I'm wrong here, alternative minimum tax on that income as well. Mm-hmm. Where does your mind go with that? I know this is down the rabbit hole, not going to apply to everyone listening to this podcast, but for my own personal sanity, help me understand as a CPA, how you determine how we should classify that income in that situation.
So there are some rules that need to be followed from section 469, which are basically your passive activity rules. However, a lot of it is going to be determined by what has been your activity status in that business. And there's a variety of different ways to calculate whether an activity is passive or active. I think there's like 6 or 7 different ways. The most common way is by using a 500-hour metric in a year. And if I spend more than 500 hours in an activity, then that activity is active, right? And the caveat to this is if I've spent, I think the timeline is 3 years. If I've been active in the business for 3 years, then that activity continues to stay active, right? So that's where, in fact, we just had a call with a client yesterday. She is receiving a rather large K-1 from a business that she's been a part of in the past. And at one point she was very active in that business and now she's no longer active in that business. We're reorganizing some of their entity structures. And that was one of her questions was, hey, if I'm not as active in this business anymore, can it be considered passive? And so we're having to go through those activity rules with her to determine, can it be active or can it be passive based on what her initial activity was. So that is something to kind of consider, but you bring up a good point because at that point, like I mentioned before, we are looking at passive activities, active activities, because in this framework or entity structure, typically our clients are instituting a holdings company, which is for their passive activities, maybe syndications, venture capital, real estate. That's all passive income by nature. And grouping those activities together. And then they typically have some sort of management company, which is for their active business investments and ownerships and activities, right? And utilizing one S corporation, I don't understand why. I mean, I could see a couple of situations why you need more than one S corporation, but for the most part, I don't understand a lot of reasons why you would need more than one S corporation to funnel all of these different business ventures and opportunities through.
So your recommendation would be if we did that entire structure, the management company would be the one that files as the S corporation because it's realizing all the active revenue. And that's correct. Where you're kind of like realizing most of your expenses anyway and doing any tax strategy.
Okay. Yeah.
Understood. That's why I'll go through my in-depth discussions with clients before while we're going through our discovery process. And they're like, yeah, I have an S corp here, an S corp here, an S corp here, an S corp. I was like, who told you to set all this up? Yeah. This one doesn't make money. So now it's like, not only are you probably not categorizing it properly, but you're also spending an additional dollar to file those S corp tax returns. Like you're just to file your taxes, it's another 20, 30 grand a year.
Yeah.
So with that, let's go over to like strategies. And I want to get to the stuff where You know, people could start taking away some things to maybe bring to their CPA immediately. Yeah. The way that I categorize taxes to keep it general is like from top to bottom, I want to identify credits because that's probably the most impactful, then depreciation, then deductions, and then deferments. Help us understand where your head goes when you're starting to consult clients in all four of those areas and maybe break down each one.
Yeah. So when I sit down with clients, I actually reverse that. Only because the quickest way to save money on taxes is to report less income.
Sure.
You pay less tax on less income, right? And so the idea of starting with our deductions is important in my opinion, because there's a lot of money that is spent on a regular basis that if it is just classified differently, not even transacted differently, but classified differently, they could probably take advantage of it. And it's money that they're already spending. There's a lot of what I call transitional expenses that business owners pay money for, but if done in the right framework, could be written off. You know, and these are some of those expenses that people hear on all the financial porn they watch, like their home office, like their cell phones, like some of the travel, like vehicles, uniforms, different things like that, right? And the reason I go with deductions is because that's the quickest way to pay a lower tax. Now, sure, for the people who hear that and just think, oh, I'm going to go spend more money, don't let the tax tail wag the dog, right? For every dollar you spend, you're only saving 20, 24 cents, whatever your tax rate is. So is it really worth it to go spend that dollar and lose out on the dollar versus keep the dollar and lose out on 24 cents, right? But the next place that we're going to go are probably some of like the maybe lesser known expenses or opportunities that keep money in my financial sphere, but they still count as a deduction. And this is where maybe we go with paying our kids, the Augusta rule, board of directors, which could be our own family members, corporate retreats with our board of directors, which, again, if we treat it right and we do everything logistically and technicality wise, then we could deduct those expenses. Then
can
the
we
next
pause
place,
right there, if you don't mind me cutting you off, because a lot of people hear this, but hearing it from someone that has truly helped clients and file and create the substantiation documentation, corporate retreat or travel with board members that are my family members, how do we go about substantiating it? Like, walk us through maybe a couple step process of making sure we're in compliance.
Excuse me. Yeah, and I'll maybe even start a little bit more foundationally. So in order for a business deduction to be a little legitimate deductible opportunity, it does have to be ordinary. It does have to be necessary. There has to be a business purpose, and I have to have documentation. Okay, those are kind of the four parameters that we go over with our clients. Now, as far as it relates to maybe this board of directors or the corporate retreats or maybe even the Augusta rule expense, right? What is the purpose? Now, if we're going to Florida to visit granny and grandpa, you know, does that have a business purpose? No, probably not. So are we going to be able to deduct it? Probably not. Now, the IRS also says that, hey, if you are going on a trip and you're working at least half of a normal work time during that trip, or you're going for the purpose of business to meet clients, to go do a convention, to do trainings, et cetera, then we have the opportunity to deduct it. So I need to keep track of maybe where I was going, what office hours I was spending working, who did I meet with, what did we talk about? If we're talking about maybe like a corporate retreat, what did we do for meetings? What did we discuss? How frequently did we have those meetings? Did you have time for some education and training? Last year, me and my partner went on a corporate retreat, and we had hours every day that were for specific planning opportunities. You know, were some of those planning meetings done poolside? Yeah, they absolutely were. I was getting a nice little tan. You know, did we have some rest and relaxation? Did we do opportunity for education and training? We absolutely did. But we took the notes and we deducted that as a corporate retreat. That was our owner's retreat for the year.
I love it. I cut you off, so I'm sorry. Did you have do you remember where you were?
I was just going to say, after we take advantage of maybe some of those expenses that, again, keep the money in my financial sphere, but I can still deduct them, then we're going to look at what is my disposable income and what can I do with that disposable income to invest in tax opportunity items. This is where with our clients, maybe we're talking a lot about real estate because we deal with a lot of real estate clients. I have a good amount of clients who love to invest in oil and gas. Oil and gas, excuse me, has great tax benefits, but it also has some good ROIs depending on the projects you're in. I've got some clients investing into tax equity projects. You know, sometimes those tax equity projects come with tax credits, like you mentioned, which are a really good source of tax savings. But those are where kind of the larger conversations take place that allow us to make more money and still pay less in taxes.
So let's go down that path, because a lot of people on this podcast have heard us talk about real estate. Haven't gone crazy granular in it inside the scope of this podcast, but everyone hears about real estate. But a lot of people don't understand the nuance that comes along with it, especially if you're a small business owner, and how to actually buy the right amount of real estate in such a way that is actually impactful off of your active income. So I definitely want to get into the weeds there. Tell us a little bit more about real estate, the advantages, and you know, the advantages of just real estate in general, but then also the tax impact that it can create. And then we'll go from there.
Yeah. So the reason why, in my opinion, real estate is one of, if not the best investments from a tax perspective, is because you should never, if you do it right, have to pay a tax on your real estate, whether that's now on the rental income, when you sell the property, or even potentially when you pass away in an inheritance tax. Okay. Now, the opportunity there, though, is because I should never have to pay a tax, on paper, my real estate should always be a loss. So it should provide me with losses to help offset the other incomes that I have, helping me save money on taxes. The thing that people get caught up in is the passive activity loss rules. Real estate is, for the most part, considered a passive activity. That being said, there are certain rules around those passive activity losses that might limit you from taking all of those losses and having them offset your incomes. There's three different real estate classifications. There's a passive real estate investor, an active real estate investor, and a real estate professional. A passive real estate investor can only use passive losses against passive incomes. Okay. And that's big for a lot of higher net worth individuals who have a really big business that they're operating with a lot of money that they are making in that business. Because at that point, unless maybe they have a passive income portfolio, or their spouse is a passive income owning individual in that business, then they can't use those real estate losses to offset that income. The second is an active real estate investor. And this is someone who does participate materially in their real estate, but they're limited. They can only write off up to $25,000 of those losses against their income if they are under $150,000 in adjusted gross income. After that $150,000, those passive losses can only offset passive incomes, fall into the same category. Now, the thing that you'll hear a lot of on social media and in this financial porn is, I can take all my losses and write off all my income with those losses. That's only reserved for a real estate professional. And a real estate professional is someone who qualifies under a two-part test. The first part being that more than 50% of the services that I perform in a year are in real property, and that I spend at least 750 aggregated hours in those activities. And when you dive into it, yes, there are ways to be able to qualify as a real estate professional, but the majority of people don't.
Sure. Another world where, let's say you own a contracting business and you remodel homes. I've seen some people make arguments mm-hmm. that you can technically be considered a real estate professional in that world. Help me understand that.
Yeah, so when you dive into the first part of that, the first test for a real estate professional, more than 50% of the services that I perform are in real property. There's been quite a number of court cases. There's quite a different number of considerations here for what is considered real property. Anyone who is involved with lending, title, real estate commission sales, maybe HVAC or plumbing or contracting, you know, a lot of those potentially could qualify as having activity in real property. the definition that the IRS has taken in a couple of different court cases. I'll give you this one. There was a guy who tried to qualify as a real estate professional, and he owned an HVAC company. However, his HVAC company didn't actually install any of the HVAC systems in the homes. He was selling his HVAC systems to the contractors who were installing in the home. So he wasn't actually dealing with the real property. He was just dealing with the systems that were being installed in the real property. And the IRS ruled against that and said he didn't qualify as a real estate professional. So there's to kind of give you an idea of how that might potentially work. The other thing really quick too that I'll add is if an individual, like for example, works in title or lending, but they do not own at least 5% of the business that they're working for, that does not qualify them under the first part of the test.
Sure. Okay. So
you have to have some ownership. Yep.
Got it. Okay, cool. That's great to know. What about short-term rentals? I hear about short-term rentals on all the financial porn that you speak of.
Yeah. So this is one that before I said most real estate is considered passive activity. Short-term rental in the right conditions could be considered active activity. And the reason why this is beneficial is because I'm no longer subject to those same passive activity loss rules. Now, the caveat though is with short-term rentals, I also have to be providing what the IRS calls substantial services for my short-term rentals. And substantial services could mean a number of different things. Maybe I'm providing daily food services, daily cleaning, rather than just more like hotel type services or bed and breakfast type services, right? Maybe I'm providing travel to and from locations. Maybe I'm providing guide services for excursions or different things like that. I can't just leave an Xbox and a go-kart at the place and call that a substantial service. I have to be actively involved. And I think that is where a lot of people get tripped up on and do it incorrectly, is they aren't providing those substantial services. But the benefit to doing this is if I'm providing those substantial services, they all now qualify as active income and active losses. So I can take all the same real estate deductions, maybe using a cost segregation analysis, get large depreciation deductions, and that, because it's now active, can offset any of my other income.
Sure. And we'll get into cost seg in 1 second here, but I guess to wrap up that the other one bullet point that I think highlights is, let's say, for example, I don't meet any of those requirements, Brady. What if I own a business and I ended up buying the building that rents out to my business and my business stays in there? Can I qualify for it then?
Potentially, but it still is going to go back to those two-part tests, right? Now, in that situation, we have a client down in Arizona who they operate and were renting for a long time and then decided to build or buy a building and move their operations to that building. Now, for that client, they are renting out a part of that building to someone else. So we did separate those into kind of that holdings and that management structure. The operations were still in that S corporation, but the asset was held in an LLC, separate, right? But they still have passive and they still have active. So unless one of the spouses could potentially qualify as that real estate professional with the more than 50% of services in that property and the 750 hours in that property, then yes, they could utilize that depreciation to offset all of the income. But if they don't, then it's still just a passive activity.
Is there ever an opportunity to do a grouping election inside of that scenario?
There are elections that you can make to elect grouping statuses for all of your properties, which again, I would advise that you do, because if not, all of your hour requirements are going to be on a per property basis, which is going to be really hard to get. So.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, cool. And then you had mentioned something called the cost segregation analysis when you were talking there. Talk to us, because when everyone was, when we first went down this path, it's like, okay, great. I get some losses. I know I have to take it each year. But cost segregation has kind of changed the game with bonus depreciation. And I know, we're still kind of in limbo on whether it's coming back or not 100%. Which is crazy to think that they didn't tell us this before April 15th. But regardless, tell us a little bit more about cost segregation and why it's so powerful in real estate.
Yeah, so any asset that is bought for your trade or business can be depreciated over the life of that asset. Basically, you take the cost of that asset and allocate a certain percentage of that cost over the life that it, the IRS has deemed it might be valuable for. What a cost segregation does is it takes a property, it's done on real estate, real property. What it does is it takes that and it breaks it down into its individual costs. So you'll have electrical, you'll have plumbing, you'll have foundation, you'll have roof. And each of those different assets have different lives or lengths of time that you can take the depreciation on. What the IRS says, though, is if you have an asset with a life of less than 20 years, you can claim bonus depreciation on that asset, which means for 2024, 60% of that can be claimed in 1 year potentially, which is rather big. You know, 2023 was 80%. I hope they bring it back to 100%. It'll help out a lot of individuals, myself included. But that allows the investors to claim a larger expense in 1 year and potentially save them more money in taxes to help reinvest that money, which is rather large.
Yeah, it's a huge deal because, you know, some people would argue back like, oh, you know, I'm still getting the same amount of depreciation over, you know, a 27 and a half or 39 year period. But when you factor in the time value of money and what mm-hmm. you can do with money back in your pocket, that's a whole nother real estate property. That's another down payment. Oh, yeah. If you're not owing the IRS the extra couple hundred grand or so.
It absolutely is.
It's a superpower right now in this game. So Brady, I know we're a little bit above the time limit. I think we're going to have to pivot to like a part two model of this thing because we could go so much deeper in the weeds. Tell us a little bit more about kind of what the vision is for you professionally as an entrepreneur and where the company's headed. And then, you know, give our listeners an idea of how they can follow you and potentially do business with you.
Yeah. Easiest way to find me is on Instagram at this point. My handle is the Brady Slack. I've got links in my bios and different opportunities for you to schedule consultations, you know, hook up with my team there. For us, we're still growing. We bring on new clients every week. We're happy to sit down, provide a free consultation, kind of get an idea of where your situation is and figure out how we can help you or if we can help you based on what your situation is. And go from there. As far as the firm, like I mentioned, we are full service tax and accounting. We provide services that start with maybe just simple monthly bookkeeping all the way up to a higher level CFO, FP&A analysis kind of engagement. And then on the tax side, yes, we still file tax returns for those who need it. But we also kind of work with our clients in a higher level planning advisory environment to make more money and pay less in taxes.
I love it. Well, Brady, thank you so much. I have to imagine there's going to be a part two coming here because we didn't even scratch the surface on anything taxes there.
I'll wait for the invite.
Thank you so much, brother.
Thanks, Antonio. Have a good one.